Hello again. This is Discover More, a podcast for independent thinkers who appreciate the importance of nuances with mental health as a through line. My name is Benoit Kim, an Ivy League educated policymaker turned psychotherapist and a world-class interviewer, according to my mom, that is. So what is the science of creativity? Today's conversation will explain the neuroscience of creativity and how to approach the creative process scientifically. Yes, you heard that right. Rich Kirkpatrick is a creativity expert, published author, and musician. Expect to learn about the nature of creativity, the three stages of the creative process by science, divergent thinking and convergent thinking, what truly is rational thinking in a creative sense, and how to unlock creative genius from within. Welcome to Discover More. Rich, welcome to Discover More.
My pleasure. I'm so glad to be here.
In the book, where you reframed Descartes, the eminent French philosopher who said, I think, therefore I am. You reframed that through I create, therefore I am. Could you elaborate?
Well, I think creativity is basically, I describe it this way, it's a way to explain what humans do when we thrive. So it's part of our identity. It's part of who we all are. And in my discovery, scientists have basically said through their research, and this seems like it's a lot of research, according to what I found, that basically we are wired like no other animal on the planet to be creative, and we all have this in us. And so just came as a way to kind of help me distill what creativity is. It's basically when I'm creating, I'm being human. I'm being a person. I'm being who I'm supposed to be.
If you really think about what separates a deity or like a god from human, it's their ability to create life. Of course, we don't have the ability, but I view art or creativity just like an additional portal to view life through or towards the greater unknown, whether that's unknown is the internal or the external. So I do see a lot of parallels between, as you said, our humans' unique ability, because our humans, we are the animals, we're the mammals with the biggest brains.
Yeah, and apparently what from our eyes to the back of the head is quite different, and the collision of things that happen, the connections that we're able to make. You know, obviously we can see in other species, they do things that are similar to mimic, but to problem solve and then to take that. And part of the problem solving is, how do I find meaning? I mean, that's an interesting problem to creatively solve, but that's kind of where us artists try to live and tackle.
So you begin chapter one with Seth Godin's quote, a prolific author and marketer. I love him and his readings. You share his quote in the book, right? And so I want to ask you another quote by his and love for you to elaborate. He says, we don't have a profit shortage problem. We have a meaning-making shortage problem. He said that in a recent interview, I see the parallels and similar threads between creativity and meaning-making. Tying that to what you just said, any thoughts there?
Zuckerberg says, or said, break things and move fast as long as you're innovating, as long as you're problem solving. But I think this bridge between science and magic addresses the meaning issue. Innovation is important, but so is art. That reason's important, but so is imagination. And so finding that seesawing or going back and forth between those things, being able to bridge those things is really our answer. Yes, we need to innovate. We need to create and solve practical problems. We also need to find meaning in things. And as artists, it's not like an artist says, here's a meaning I'm going to create. It's like they create and then somehow the meaning happens. That's the magic part of it. Picasso said, people find meaning in my work, but I never intended it. I didn't like force that to happen. I think I got the translation right from a book that was in French that I was reading. But he was making that statement. I think that's really true for those who are artists really could relate to that you create something. Someone says, wow, that's really meant a lot to me. Well, your process of creating meant a lot to you, gave you meaning. But then when you create it, somehow there's meaning brought to the people who listen or buy your product even.
I do. That's a great point, because I think a great piece of work like film or classic movies, it's interesting because different fans and different viewers derive and interpret different mission statements or different meanings from the same movie. And I have heard a lot of directors and a lot of movie folks, they're like, oh, that's actually not the intended meaning of this film, but then people derive differently. And I never thought about that. It's not about creating meaning, but can you derive or interpret meanings? Because I do feel like
in a way, life is inherently meaningless, but I view that as a very empowering way. Because if there is no predestined and predetermined meaning, that means we have the leeway and the free will to seek meanings that really it's appropriate and fits in our containers of realities that we live in.
I think if you only think creativity is utility, then meaninglessness is very stark and painful. But if you think of creativity as something that actually makes a life that could find meaning, even if it's for other people, then that's empowering. But I think that's kind of the distinction sometimes. It's like, okay, if all I'm there to do is be a robot and solve problems, I'm not going to be like these two characters, the robot and the wizard in the book, the wizard who has this weird dream about something that doesn't make sense at first. So meaning, by the way, doesn't have to make sense, but when it does, it's magical.
That reminds me of the book, The Alchemist. Are you familiar with Alchemist?
I'm familiar with it.
Classic. And of course, the whole ethos of the book is, as a child, we are gifted with this ability to imagine dreams that are larger than us. For the protagonist, obviously, he was instilled with this dream that there is this secret treasure hidden, like 4,000 miles away for this child, and his journey to pursue that dream. But I think, as you said, that through time, through whatever reasons, through being more practical, being more realistic, our dreams shrink. As a child, you want to be an astronaut. You want to be a president of the world. That's not even a title. I want to be the president of the universe. Not a thing. But people, their dreams have not been tainted by air quote realism. But as you get older, your dreams shrink, you evolve, you adapt. And then for a lot of people, when you look back, you're like, whoa, I'm just a shell of self. All this creativity, this life, this meaning that we're inherently born with as a kid, they fickle over time.
Every child feels they can dance or draw or become an NBA player or whatever it is that captures our imagination. Now, the reality is not everybody will be, but to not allow that part of ourselves to continue at some level, I think is something that damages us. That's where I create, therefore I am, means, you know, maybe what I'm creating isn't this huge business enterprise. Maybe it's this incredible hobby I have where I invite my friends over and have cigars and we talk about something. Every Tuesday night, I created something, created a moment that helped me find meaning, and my job is fine. I think we expect too much, you know, expectations when they don't meet reality, that's the definition of disappointment. So we're always disappointed because the realities don't match the expectation, but that's not about dreaming. We can still have realistic expectations. We will then find the gap. The creativity comes in, how can I go from this realistic expectation of what I can do to iteratively change myself, for instance, to the dream I have?
So the undercurrent of that is creativity is a process and not an outcome. Can you elaborate why that is? Because like the sayings of muses, the light bulb moments, I think these sayings give us the illusions that this is something external and you have to really wait for the miracle to happen and then you're creative. But your book and the immense research you dove into dispels that myth that it's actually not an outcome. It's actually the process.
Yeah, and the process is where the magic is, by the way. And this process is the stuff that we don't celebrate often. We love the story of a giant leap, a character finally in the third act, something changes, their whole life's changed. And we all know in reality that the stories give us a direction, but what they don't give us is how to get there. The movies or the stories or books aren't lying to us, but what they're not doing is they're not filling in all the blanks. Otherwise, it wouldn't be interesting. So the stories become these anchor points, become these points of inspiration for us to keep the process going. So I wanted to be a musician, and as a young person, it just captured me. I had to give up playing ball and going out riding my bike with friends as a 12, 13, 14-year-old, just playing on the piano. My brothers would get annoyed at me. I had to stick with that. That process, this dream in my head of how do I recreate the sound that I heard on the radio, or how do I do that? And then years later, I took music theory lessons. So all those iterative steps got me closer to a dream of what is it like to reproduce music? And the dream didn't die because I kept the process in place. And I explain, you know, the basically three steps or iterations that we go back and forth between, not really in a straight line, which is discovery, development, and delivery. And the metaphors I use for that is the dream, the sandbox, and the story. And these are ways for us to kind of anchor back and forth a process. But unlike a lot of processes, the creative process is not a straight line. It's not always visible to us even. And it is something we can get better at. That's the good news about it being a process, by the way. Not that it's more exciting, because it's not, but that you can actually change something.
And the fact that it's a process implies that there's room for growth and room for mistakes. Because if it's a finite outcome, it seems like gloom and doom. Oh, if it's an outcome, it's fixed. It's like fixed mindsets versus growth mindset. Mm. But I think that's the hope and that's the message I got is if it's a process, then you can adapt and tweak that over time, which implies area for growth.
And the other thing is too, we're on a spectrum. We're not all the same. That's one reason why I came up with this idea of robots and wizards. One of the scientists, Shelley Carson, explains how we enter the process differently, even though the brain kind of operates the same way with creativity, but how we start differently. So even, say, two musicians, just as an example, one's a robot, one's a wizard. The robot is going to map out, I need a song that's 3 minutes and 30 seconds. It's going to be in this key. Here's the person I'm writing it for. And so they've created kind of this very detailed thing like a scientist would. The wizard's going to say, I'm at my piano and I'm singing something. I'm just all of a sudden writing things down. So how we begin creativity is really sometimes why we call some of our peers, this is person's creative because he's like the artist, because he somehow just gets ideas, and this person's not because they're really methodical. Well, the truth is those two people need to be the same person in some ways, and bridging between those two things is how that process really works on whatever edge it is that we're not as sharp at. So for me, I kind of look like I'm an artist on the outside, but an engineer on the inside. Uh-huh. You know, how do I solve this problem? And so people would assume because, you know, maybe it's because I have some Latin in me or whatever, I'm expressive, that that's the thing that I am. But my secret to success has been the robot, finding a process. How much is it going to take me to learn this piece? Should I take this gig or is it going to lead me in the wrong direction? And so a lot of times this is what we have to figure out. How we start creativity, just like any process. Do we start with discovering an idea, or do we start, you know, in dream? Do we start with workshopping it something and seeing what works and what's needed and what's practical? Or do we start with a story, which is delivery? Do you start, what are people needing? There's no wrong answer to that, but we have to touch each of those bases in order to come up with something great. It's just, you can't tell a person, come up, like Archimedes in the bathtub, I got the light bulb, eureka. And that can't happen every day. So how does it happen? It happens in a process.
Mm. I love your robots, the symbols of your robots and wizard. Of course, robot is like the engineering, the scientist lens, and wizard is a creative lens, traditionally speaking. And once again, the undercurrent of that is convergent thinking and divergent thinking. Mm. And as you know, Rich, that recently with psychedelic research, cannabis usage through microdosing intentionality matters, right? You can't just free fall. I'm just going to smoke a couple of joints and see where it takes us. You have to set intention, just like psychedelic therapy, which is my background. So I'd love for you to define what convergent and divergent thinkings are, because I sense this iterative dances between you have to go back and forth. And of course, your book talks about that. And that's a process. Just like humans are multidimensional. And likewise, with creative process, you have to dance between the realm of convergent thinking and divergent thinking.
That one idea seemed to be really central to a lot of research because it said these are the ways that the brain, now that they can map them while a person's creating, actually work. And so the convergent thinker is kind of the standard where we take a bunch of things and we put them in a list, we put them in order, we edit out, we reduce the clutter, we're using executive function a lot. That is convergent thinking. And that's, we train that, we need that for safety on our FAA. We're glad that they use that all the time. Mm-hmm. And they're always thinking, are these things in order with all the data that comes in? Divergent thinking, by nature of the word, is something different. And it's where you take one idea, perhaps, and you go to many places. You start in one place and you can go in 100 different places. So you're basically creating ideas, idea generation. Cognitive disinhibition, I think I got that right. You open your mind to a certain degree to allow things in, but intentionally, not to a point where everything comes in. Like, I have slight ADHD, so I know what that feels like. You know, so, you know, some medication helps me to stimulate so I can like have some regulation of, okay, this is the thoughts I'm allowing in. It actually gives me a superpower in a way because my mind's open randomly as I'm watching TV and I want to write something down. Some people might relate to that. That's divergent thinking. I had a boss one time, I shared this story, who said, Rich, you come to the right conclusions. And this guy's brilliant. He had photographic memory. 3 years, he would remember a meeting. He'd have to take notes. I mean, genius, right? But he was telling me, you're getting the right results, going the right direction, but you think backward. I'm like, really? What do you mean by that? And I had to really soak that in. I thought something was wrong with me. There's nothing wrong with him or me in that sense. What he didn't understand was how I was operating was opposite to him. I was starting my creativity at a different place with divergent thinking. He started creativity with convergent thinking. If he were to deconstruct how he was successful at what he did, he would realize there were times where he had to be open to more ideas. He just didn't see the order that I had that in and how I bridged between the two in my sequence is the same as his. And so he thought, something's wrong with you. And I thought he might be right, by the way, at the moment, and had to kind of work through that. And that's one of the motivations for writing a book like this, by the way, is like having to describe, is there something wrong with me, you know, in general? And then I find out I have friends who have the same issues. Well, he's better than me, and they're saying something's wrong with him or her. So actually being able to go and read what scientists say and hear what friends who are psychologists say about this divergent and convergent thinking has opened a lot of doors for me to grow myself and to inspire other people.
I see some parallels where I started the podcast because I used to grapple with this loneliness. I said, I must be the only one have this esoteric interest, thinking about astrophysics and spirituality, the afterlife, the near-death experiences, NDEs, but also very grounded in science because I'm a social scientist by trade. Until I discovered podcasting, I said, wait a minute, there's all these people out there who are cut from the same cloth, pretty much. They're rigorous scientists by day, but at night, they're painters or they have all these different interests. And in a way, it really reduced my loneliness that, oh, I see. There are people out there that are trying to merge esoteric with a more rigorous ergo discipline. But with that being said, Rich, from your research, aside from the fact that there are biomarkers and there are genetic variations, of course, but would you say that most people have access to both divergent and convergent thinkings? And what are some of the patterns or themes you have noticed from your research?
The research shows 80% are convergent thinkers by preference, and 20% are divergent thinkers. So for me, thinking something's wrong with me, a lot of that had to do with the math of just who's expressing it. Some of those convergent thinkers may have people who have learned that. And that's where the other question came in about, is this something that we both have? It is. Because even though I'm a divergent thinker, I had to show up to meetings on time. I used to have a problem with that because I would get lost in Cairo's time and there was no clock. I was in the flow of something. And oh no, I have a meeting. I didn't show up. And then I had, in that process, was learning convergent thinking. I'm sorting through what's important on my schedule now. And I have these skills. What's priority for tasks? You know, even though if you're ADHD, you know, supposedly a problem, well, you can learn. You can learn behaviors that help you because we are able to sort as humans. 80% of us do it really well. It's good news for the artist to know that they can grow in that. The best artists have habits. So my daughter, who's an illustrator, she did this October thing. She did a flower watercolor for 31 days in October. This is the things that artists, if you find on Instagram or whatever artists, this is how they challenge each other. This challenge is kind of like, you know, I had a personal trainer once because I'm not an athlete and I wanted to get better at it. And I bought a bicycle and it helped me, but I needed to get further. So, well, the trainer did, he broke things down and gave me these habits that helped me. I said, wow. And I don't have to become that convergent thinker, but I have to be willing to know that as to thrive in creativity that someone has to.
I love that because I think by nature, I am more of a convergent thinker. I'm also a veteran, so discipline and consistency for me comes very naturally. At the same time, in the last 4 years since I started this podcast, I could visibly and palpably feel that my divergent thinking ability has increased quite a lot. My ability to break down one idea into many different ideas, and for my ability to connect the abstract to the concrete, connecting agriculture with mental health, creativity with neuroscience, spirituality with science, all these different things, I think was the byproduct of this iterative process of me engaging in these week-to-week conversation with 85 plus guests to this point. And I think there's a huge messaging of hope. Where once again, back to nature and nurture, currently the clinical data shows that about 20 to 30% are genetics. And about 70 to 80% are epigenetics, or that's a nurturing based on environmental feedback, the zip code you're born into, the sort of family dynamics, the attachment style, and so on. But the fact is, as you said in the beginning of these conversations, our humans, we are very malleable and we can recondition and decondition and through that iterations many folds. We don't have to just say, oh, here's the deck of cards I've been given 40 years ago. That's the same deck of cards I'm going to die with. It's like, hold on. You can, it's a process, right? Just like life.
And sometimes what happens is we wait for an event that unsettles us to discover these things. My hope is that people don't have to do that because it's unsettling. And to go back to the health issue with me getting a trainer, what the impetus for that was, I had a scan that said, you have this huge thing in your chest. Mm. And I couldn't get results for a while. And that, you know, the look on the medical professional's face was pretty scary. And I had a health scare years before that. So I was really concerned. And then come to find out, you know, there was a condition that if a hemochromatosis, it's called, so it made me really tired. And somehow we were able to diagnose it. The doctor, she did an incredible job where for years, no one else did. And so they basically give you phlebotomies to get the iron because there's an iron overload thing and it affects your moods, it affects your energy, and it's poisoning your body, essentially. So in that process, it got me to think, okay, existentially, you know, I have something in my chest possibly, but even if I don't, you have that thought of, okay, well, what am I doing with life? And so, you know, that's when I mentioned I bought a bicycle and then I got a trainer and I went through all those little steps. In that, I discovered that it was great. Really, the question now is, am I going to be in this moment? And that's really a biggest challenge, I think, for me, and maybe others can relate to that. So creativity, because it's a process, but also this dream, it's this science thing that I need to write down and organize, but it's also this imagination thing that I need to explore and lose myself to some degree. That dance might allow me to be in this moment. If I'm not in this moment, then I'm going to divert from dreaming. What they say is salary is a tool to help you forget your dreams.
Wow.
And that's what happens in life to us. It's our goal is to get a big enough salary. At least when I was younger, that was the goal. And then that way, you know, you would achieve something that was happiness. But really, if all it is to keep you from what you're really dreaming about, is it really worth the salary? And we sometimes look for these big events, these giant leaps, as opposed to taking steps. And the reason is because the steps are hard sometimes, mm-hmm. especially when you're starting out. Who wants to be a novice again? I had to be a novice writer years ago when I started writing. And you know, being a musician who was the youngest student at music school, everyone hated because I got in young and I challenged out the first year and thought that would make friends. But I made the opposite. When you're 18, you don't know that. Mm-hmm. So now, last 10 years or whatever, as someone learning to write and to speak, I said, well, this is a whole different world. I'm a novice. You know, maybe you've had like, what, 85 or 90 people. I think I've been on like 35 or 40. So how many of those 10,000 hours or whatever that is it going to take for me to actually, well, I can do this by muscle memory and I'm even more valuable. But I had to start somewhere and keep doing it and keep stepping forward. And I think that's the hope in it, is that the dreams don't have to be shattered. They just have to be, okay, how am I going to get there?
Yeah, I mean, Malcolm Gladwell, 10,000 hours, and also Naval Ravikant, they talk about all best things in life compound over time. And so, of course, that also implies the process, because for the compounding to take place, you have to see the course, right? That's simple as that. But I do want to ask you a question, and I would love to revisit your three stages, the dream, the sandbox, and the story. And of course, according to your book, they're based on the godfather of creativity, Graham Wallace's research on four stages of creativity back in 1920s or 30s, I believe. So tying to what you just said, Rich, this back and forth, right? You learned to be a writer 10 years ago. You went from an expert musician to a novice writer. But of course, change is scary. And I used to say change is hard. I've reframed that. And now I say change is effortful, because I do feel like all worthy things in life are effortful.
That's a t-shirt, man. I would buy that t-shirt.
Maybe that could be the Discover merch. But the undercurrent of that is the non-linearity of life, that life is non-linear, just like your career pivots, your development. But like, what is the relationship between creativity and the non-linearity of life, tying to what you just said?
Yeah, and those steps, like you said, they're not linear. You could start at either one and you may have to go back. So to summarize what those were, like the dream is the idea generation and the sandbox is where the limitations are found. And that's where you research and develop things. And then the story is where you get it ready to deliver it to the world. So in that process, as anything goes, whether it's a podcast or a book that I wrote, whatever it is, you say you have the idea, you're workshopping it in the sandbox, and you go to the story part, you realize, oh, the thing I didn't think was my sub idea is actually what people really resonate with. So you go back to your ideas and you start to make more, generate more ideas about that. So that's kind of how that works. And then being able to bridge that is really a change in thought. There's this interesting thought, and I didn't really find a complete consensus on this, but so you have divergent and convergent thinking, but then there's lateral thinking, which is kind of the switch. And so making that switch quickly is what a lot of the researchers say is what a super creative person can do, because they can take, okay, now I'm working on limitations, which are really practical. Well, now I got to go back to dreaming again, and I have to find more ideas because I've already finished this list of things I've been working on. But being able to do that quickly, whether that means it's in, depending on what you're creating, it's months or years or hours. So it's really a dance, and our personal growth and our lives are a lot like that. We have to prepare. We create with the materials around us, like you were talking about. We don't create life, but as living creatures, what we breathe in is what we breathe out. And so this idea of breathing in and breathing out, inspiration, the whole idea of the word inspire is to breathe in. And so what we breathe out when we create, one researcher said it's like yoga, where you have an open position and then a closed position. You can't do them both at the same time. And so this is the thing that kind of frustrates some of us, because we're, you know, back to the divergent and convergent thinking. We have to be careful about having some separation between these modes. And that's why the geniuses do it so quickly. We think they're doing it at the same time. And they might even think they're doing it, but really the brain can't. It has to kind of switch a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Now that's great. And I just sense a universal truth from what you said. One of the biggest misconceptions is multitasking. People have this misbelief that you can multitask. That's not true. People switch task. Certain people switch tasks faster to give you the allure that they are multitasking. You can't multitask. Your brains are literally incapable of that. So I sense the same thing where, right, you're switching faster and back and forth. And that's the reason why I love these stages and why it's very flexible and nonlinear, because you need the due diligence. You need the preparations. You need to collect data points. And you have to leave some room for the magic happened, but you can't surrender without the due diligence. When people are like, oh, surrender, that doesn't mean giving up. That doesn't mean not doing anything. Surrender is not synonymous with inaction. It actually requires action, just like flow states. According to research, some of the core ingredients that allow flow state to emerge is preparations, but a little scaffolding of discomfort, a little bit of nerves, and surrender, and then flow state achieves. Mm. But if you're doing something that's repetitive, very easy autopilot, you cannot enter flow state. What is true is true. And I think you can find that truth in different slices of life and different domains.
And that's one reason that why the creative process mesmerized me, because it really intersects with so many things that are human. That's why one of the ways I describe creativity is what humans do when we thrive. And so another way of even looking at that, switching that and saying, to thrive, we need to be more creative. Mm. So that's part of it. And people who've journaled, there was some research I found where they journaled their traumas as they were being treated for cancer and some other illnesses. And in doing so, they found two results. One, they improved physically from journaling their traumas. And the second result was they became more empathetic towards other people. I was always taught young to very fundamentalist kind of environment, rich, that, you know, don't trust psychology and self-actualization is going to ruin you and all this. But what it's saying is when I can be seen and see myself properly, I can see other people and I can heal. And so I create, therefore I am, is also saying I create so I can heal. So I can heal and I can be useful to other people in a way. And I think that's a very empowering thing. And I found that fascinating and very enlightening about what creativity can do to us.
To go even a level deeper, when you talked about journaling, trauma helps them heal. And I love the idea that I create so I can heal, or I heal so I can create. Because when you're not thriving, you don't have room and capacity for creativity. When you're worrying about putting food on the table, paying bills, you don't have the ability or capacity to pull out a canvas and start painting, right? So there's a lot of truth there. But there is a famous documented studies where for men who are maybe less empathetic towards women or even have some sort of a misogynistic tendencies, if they are first born as a daughter, they actually go through epigenetic changes. They become more empathetic towards women. And it's permanent changes. So once again, when certain men with sexist tendencies, right, if their firstborn is a daughter, their personality actually shifts. And this has been documented, and they become more empathetic towards women. So in that sense, I create literally heals them and helps them transform to a better, improved versions. You alluded to original thoughts and creativity earlier. I love to go in there. From your personal and or research, what do you think is a relationship between original thoughts and creativity, if any?
The Bible, King Solomon said, there's nothing new under the sun. And so part of that is really reflecting this idea that we create with the stuff that we have. There's a French researcher that I read who invention as opposed to intention. And so in the idea of intention, I want to create this original thing, is going to block you. It's going to just be this wall. And I've tried that before. But what your job is to iterate with that, to invent something out of what the stuff is that you are and it's around you. The freedom in that is that's what I have. I know I can have that. I know I can make more of it because I can learn more, experience life more. All those things can give me more of this reservoir to create with. And so as opposed to intending, here's this thing I'm going to artificially impose on the world or on myself, I am looking at the realities, actually more realities. I'm being seen and seeing the world more clearly as possible so that I can extract that. Great business people, they have an eye for what really is going on. That's why they're great at what they do. You know, they may not even be organized. But I know some of these people, they just see this is what's happening and they're able to jump on it when no one else is kind of distracted over here trying to create a reality that doesn't exist anymore or can't, where the materials changed. So originality then becomes my iteration with a unique set of genetics and information and input and experience and failures.
In a way, I've never made this connection until now. This is the reason why I love podcasting. I am also learning constantly. It's like an egoic intention behind being original, right? I have to be the first to discover or uncover this thing versus the intention of creating something valuable. Even like creating demand or finding supply and demand for business and entrepreneurship, for us to do that, economics has to be established. Marketplace has to be established. And then through the established concept, then we say, oh, supply and demand, right? But that's not original either. And I hate this Western over fixations on unconditional love. Like a lot of people, they are dissatisfied with their relationships or they have certain conflicts with their parents or whatever. And they're like, oh, love is impure because it's not unconditional. To that, I want to ask, why does it have to be unconditional? Love is love, because love is a greater extent of ourselves. And that's very effortful, right? For your spouse, romantic love, companion love, friendship love. To me, I think conditional love is okay, because the world is not a loving place often. So as long as there's love in place, it doesn't have to be conditional or conditional. But similar to the originality, I think people get overly fixated and caught up, as you said. I have to be original versus actually intention versus invention versus actually trying to create something.
If a person is forced to think that way, they have to be able to make the conditions or change them for it to be unconditional. Just like they have to make something that doesn't exist at all come into existence to be God. So you have to be God to be that. Mm-hmm. And we're not. We have to sleep. We have to, you know, we have the constraints of time and space with our own bodies and our own failures, our own limitations, our eyesight, how we can see a person. All those things do matter. And so I would like to say we need to love as best humans can love. The condition is we love as humans and we love to get the best for each other. So I don't have to give a person 100%. Unconditionally, who I don't know, to love them. But if I'm a human being, I want what's best for them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the difference. I can have some level of empathy. Maybe it's more of an intellectual empathy because I can't handle everything, right? I can't have so many people that I have this bond with. I can save that level of higher connection to the people I commit my life to and the choice I make for that, which we should. But to then impose that on everybody, it's like, forgive the world for everything or whatever. I think part of that is a trap, and not to get into kind of theological thing, but I do think people want to be God in that kind of statement. And that's going to fail. What's more true is to say, here's my opportunity to love. Am I going to do it or not? And that's the choice we make. Mm-hmm. It's not so much that I have to give everything and think, you know, I'm bound to that. No, I'm bound to be given agency in love, because love is about agency. It's about choices. It's about choosing. Was a famous at every wedding. It's 1 Corinthians 13 chapter about what love is kind, it's patient, it's all of these different things. Well, those are all choices and habits I make. So in order to love, the conditions are my capacity for patience and my capacity for humility, my capacity for boundaries so I have energy to love. All of that matters. And when we kind of like turn it into this thing, what we're really doing is we're saying to people, I want to see you fail, so I'm going to tell you to love everybody. Well, I don't do it. And oftentimes, you know, in kind of spiritually abusive situations, that's what happens, is they get the power that way by making a person feel indebted to do, to live a behavior that they never do, but that serves their power. What's empowering, though, is kind of what you're saying, is we have agency in this. And that's what makes a love in the first place, that I get to choose.
Just that creativity, you get to choose to create.
You got to choose to create. And it is a lot like love, because it's the conditions are all about, do I have enough hours to do this? How do I make the hours to do this? You know, I have a very supportive family. I could not do anything that I'm doing right now had I not have that. That takes choices of me to invest in my family, but for them to trust me. And those are all things in all conditions, if you put it in that term, about what love is. And so creativity, again, about human thriving, when you have those relationships, you have that freedom to create, or at least more freedom than you would have if you had not. We uphold the starving artist or the struggling artist as kind of this trope about what it is like. Yeah, there's struggle and, like you said, effort. But if there's a certain level of effort that goes beyond that is terrible, like in Ukraine, one thing that broke my heart when the war started, there was this band that they stopped touring, and the Ukrainian musicians, because I'm a musician, we're like, oh my gosh, this is terrible. Now they have guns, guitars to guns. It should be the other way, guns to guitars, right? That's kind of, if you're a Christian, there's this, swords to plowshares, you know? They were doing, the war does opposite, and it kills creativity literally, because then young people like them are then taken out of that zone because they got to protect their families. And that's a conditional love again, but it stops the creativity. And you have school teachers who can no longer educate children to have a safe experience, to have in them more they can love and create with. And so this is why I think war is really evil, one of the most evil things, because we destroy what people have created, and then we stop what could have been created, the potential, by the loss of life and loss of safety that people have.
The core ethos of that is we need to propose, not impose, right? And also, I do want to go into limitations and conditions, since you alluded to many folds. I think this will surprise a lot of people, where society, especially Western culture, we have this, once again, illusion that absolute freedom is what we want. That's actually not true. That's when paralysis by analysis, you talked about in the book, if you give a painter an open canvas with no guidelines, they'll freak out, right? Because you need the conditions, you need the constraints. I went from, in my early 20s, believing absolute freedom is what I desire, to now in my 30s, I think disciplined and constrained freedom is, and I know that, I thrive with certain conditions.
If you were to go back to the sandbox, that's the place where we have this. And I call this beauty of limitation. It's kind of like, a child literally plays in the sandbox, like I did as a kid. Parent knows you have these boundaries, stay within that. As you get older, you have a meadow, perhaps, so you play ball within this field and has trees or a fence around it. All the things we do, even for play, have boundaries and limitations to them. And there's a reason for that. One is for safety, because, you know, the world's a scary place. A small child could run out to the street and things like that that do happen. And so we have that. My dog has a leash. I have a new puppy, and the boundaries make him happier because he's learning how to live in the world. He's only been alive for a few months. He's just trying to figure out. So it really is a way of constructing my life, is being able to find out what are those limitations. Think of it this way. Miracles actually happen in time and space. So there was, okay, the birth of Jesus is a miracle. The GPS location and a calendar date, whether we have it accurate or not is not the point, but somewhere this person was born, and that was considered a miracle. Something in the world changed. Our calendars changed. We still use it thousands of years later. So the limitations really are about finding what reality is and then deciding, you know, what piece of it we're going to work within. If I'm going to write a song, like I mentioned before, do I need it to be a 3-minute, 30-second song? Or can I write, you know, is it a symphony? It's unnerving to not have the limitations talked about and to not have that. So a lot of the artists would understand this. The thing is about us artists is we don't necessarily want to tell management that we want limitations, because we want as much budget, as much time to complete it. But at the same time, we have to have, whether self-imposed or externally imposed, you know, limits on it. And I did mention in the book, this one guy who was a Fortune 100 executive who raised his hand when I was presenting this material, he was rich. I thought you guys want to know boundaries. And he was literally flabbergasted. This is a brilliant person. I was shocked, you know. But it really taught me a lot how, though, this is important to explain for those of us divergent thinkers, how we need that convergent order of things. And that's what those are, those limitations.
I didn't think I would be making multiple connections between love and creativity, but here's another one connection I just made. Love is boundless, but our capacity for love is not boundless. It's bounded by our 24 hours a day, how many people that we have, our ability to not just cultivate, but maintain meaningful relationships in life. Because having relationships does not mean having meaningful relationships. So I think that's the same thing with unconditional, right? People focus on the condition versus unconditional, and they forget the love. So in that sense, I do think constraints and limits are the realistic aspects, and we do need that. Is there any other topics that came up during your research for this book and beyond that surprised you? That, this is what I used to believe and uphold, but through my research and writing this book, that's actually not the case. And feel free, it's a very vast question, so feel free to take where you see fit.
I think one thing that really challenged an earlier view of myself and others in life is that my intuition is something I should listen to. Mm. What my body tells me, in other words, what I feel is internal, which, you know, your body's connected to thoughts. And so I was kind of taught religious view that you are disconnected. Your mind and your soul and your body are these three different things that aren't really connected. And so long as your soul's saved, you're great. But you live in your body. You live in this limitation. And so the things I would feel sometimes, I was told, oh, you might feel that, but that's not real. Or don't listen to that. Well, in studying the creative process and learning how the brain works and learning, you know, what curiosity is and why I would ask questions and get in trouble, you know, I want to go back to that kid and say, that's okay that you're asking questions. You might need to be more polite asking the question, but it's okay that you're asking the question. This is what you're feeling. You may be acting out in a way that is inappropriate, but to feel that is to be human. And so in creativity, the idea that to create, therefore I am, is that you're basically being grounded in the person you are. So if my body's telling me something, I'm listening to it. One of the things that hit me in this regard was a scientist who said that imagination is logical. And I was like, what do you mean imagination is logical? And she described it as if I was walking to the precipice or to the edge of a cliff, and my body started to really tighten up, and I was feeling anxiety, all these things, and thoughts racing through my head. And what she was saying as a brain scientist, well, you're being logical, because these are things that could happen to you being on the edge where you could fall and be harmed or dead. And that's logical. It helped me realize that, am I listening fully? Am I present enough in life to listen fully to what my body's actually saying to me? So I'm in a situation and I feel uncomfortable. Well, why do I? Is it because I have something I haven't dealt with somewhere in the past? Or is it just because in this moment, this is not safe? Creativity is what people do when we thrive. Then I said, okay, then I create, then I'm listening to this part of me, that muscle that I have to learn to do that better now. And so that's kind of put me on, you know, this is a new thing, honestly. You know, I like to get internal and think intellectually, but then to also be willing, well, why am I feeling this way? That part I have to grow further and I think to create better.
This is awesome. So I love your connections about how imagination is logical. I'm going to go down quite a bit of a rabbit hole real quickly, but I used to fall under this too, but I think a lot of men, when our partners and spouses and significant others come to us and they want to be heard, they want us to create a space for them. I think a lot of us, our instinctive move is to problem solve, offer solutions. Personality traits, right? Since men and women, they do behave and think differently. But then what I learned over time is that's not what they want. So logically, when you have a problem, you seek solutions. But then I was like, wait a minute, in a relational, emotional capacity and in the different relationship with different person, the most logical thing to do by the definition of logic is doing what's most optimal based on the circumstances at hand. Men are proud of self, we are problem solvers. We want to provide solutions. If our partners and our spouses are not appreciative of that, we're actually doing an illogical thing. So the most logical thing to do at that time is actually appeasing and doing what they want, because intention versus impact. Logical thing is not what we deem as logical. Logical thing is based on the outcome. So in that sense, I do think imagination is logical. And I never made that connection until now.
It does allow me then to solve things differently. And I think empathy sometimes is an intellectual thing. Mm-hmm. We always focus on the emotional, vulnerable part of it. But like, as you described, it's a choice. It's like love's a choice. Well, this is a point I know this is going to have this outcome because I'm committed to this person. And so I'm going to make these choices in that. And therefore, you know, maybe at the moment I'm not feeling great. Like parents, you know, having raised two kids. So I don't always have to be vulnerable in that sense, except for the point of thinking of another person. And that's my choice, the agency I'm putting in.
Choice will definitely be a key word for our episode. But speaking of this realm between logic, emotions, practicality, imaginations, I want to ask you about this thing you shared with me offline. And I'd love for you to elaborate further because I think it's a beautiful connection. You said, one thing I learned is that it's okay to be emotional, mystical, imaginative, just as much as it is to be rational, practical, utilitarian. But why is it okay to be both? Because, you know, America, we love picking one or the other.
The issues we deal with in even having a conversation is what this is about. Being willing to see another person. And I call that embracing the awkward, this thing right here. Am I willing to embrace the awkward, which could be my uncle, you know, when he comes over for holidays and it's or whatever the person is that I don't want to, you know, if they're too left wing or right wing, whatever it is, I can see two people as human if they seem opposite, for instance. And then in myself, I should be willing to do the work to, again, it's a choice of love, to see what is it like to be that person. We are a little bit complicated sometimes. There are nuances. You know, Martin Luther of the Reformation said we are both saints and sinners, which I think to me is this tension. So we live in a tension of the dark side we have and the light side that we have. And I think he said it beautifully, and I think it really helps us see, if I have a light and dark side and I can't see that person's light side, I have to be willing to dig and find that out. Or the person seems to all have no dark side, it might not be completely safe. And I think it's a good journey for us in our society to be able, like I said, embrace the awkward, which is including the awkward part of ourself, to know that we are saints and sinners, and to know that in that framework and limitation that we have, our conditions, as you mentioned, that we have, we can make choices still. We're not completely bound to our genes, our family histories. We have choices to make.
Yeah, I love that we are both sinners and saints. And I think that speaks to the flexibility of life. Because I think when we're more flexible internally, the reality we view life through also becomes more flexible. And I'm speaking this for myself because I struggle with black and white thinking, because I'm very disciplined, because I'm very good at being consistent. That's my strength. But that very strength is also my very downfall, because I'm more rigid. And flexibility is my biggest growth edge. Continue to do so in my 30s. But I love what you said, because sinners, saints, love, unlove, condition, decondition, it talks about that. It's a process. And when there's process, there's room for growth, room to adapt, evolve. But beautifully said, I think that's amazing.
Thank you.
I used to say this in the podcast and also offline, where routine, this is not my original thoughts, right? But routine creates productivity, but novelty inspires. And as you know, like Jerry Seinfeld, a lot of great creatives, they go to a hotel, lock themselves in to finish a book, or they go through these, like they see novelty, right? A change of scenery, change of location, they travel. But then when you want to be productive, you want to be routines. You want to prime yourself with the conditions and the environments you're familiar with. Like if you're preparing for an exam, you want to make sure you're eating the same breakfast. If you have like a monumental exam, like licensure, you don't want to try new things the day of. That would be a disaster, right? So where do you see that balance, or do you have any thoughts in terms of routine drives productivity and novelty drives inspirations and creativity?
I know I can learn a lot from you because I'm kind of the opposite of you. The flexibility is on a high level and the structure is like, what structure? But the reality is over the years, like I explained earlier in our conversation about learning how to be on time, for instance, applying that idea here, like to write a book, having routines was very important. How many words, and you don't do this forever. Again, that's why creativity is a process. You don't have to be that person forever. And that will help a lot of super creative people like me understand you're not changing fundamentally what your preferred style is. But when it comes to that big exam, when it comes to the book that I wrote here, what can I do to be productive for seasons of time? And if you could break your life into that, because I prefer rhythms that I can go in and out of. Okay, 1,000 words a day I was doing. So I had to write like, you know, 80,000 words, and then editor had to read it and send back the notes. And then I had to rewrite 40,000 words, an additional 30,000 words, and it ends up coming up with a total of 60,000 words at the end after it's been, after. But the routine to get that was the writing. You have to just keep writing. The things that are painful that are the most productive that you need to do are the things that no one really knows about. I mean, people who read my book aren't seeing, you know, the condition of torment I was trying to get 1,000 words some of those days. Some were easy, some weren't. And they call it your junk draft because you're just getting this thing out. But that's how, when we have a routine, that's how we get those difficult things out. But I think the thing answer to that is to not see either of these as like the, what is that, Satan sinner part? Because it could be saying that, but what makes me the most human in that situation? Is it to write the book, to be more human? I got to get through this, so I need that 1,000 words. Another person could do 500 and take longer, and they're happier. But for me, I needed that. Then that's what I should choose. How does it affect the relationships around me? You know, it's what's that moment? What's my life? Does my life matter, I guess, is the question in these decisions. If the constraint of a routine is so severe that it harms me in some way because I feel trapped by it, maybe I need to, you know, a different routine. Maybe it's not the routine that's a bad thing. Maybe I just don't know how to make a routine. So I think those are the issues in the creative process that I hope to kind of uncover for myself as that person who showed up late all the time, who needed the scaffolding. So it's true. It's proven. My daughter, who's a visual artist, October, 31 days of a watercolor painting of a flower every day. That's what you just choose that. That routine grew her skill in watercoloring and flowers. And researching and studying what these different flowers were, 31 different flowers. 31 paintings, that's a lot in a month. So yeah, it makes you more productive. And there's seasons for that. So you're preparing and the preparation phase, bingo. That's when you do as much as you can in that, especially if you're a younger person. I mean, you know, practice your music instrument if you think you're going to, that's your career. Just like you would if you're going to be a lawyer, you're going to practice, you know, read these books and, you know, watch these films or whatever it takes for you to become more adept at what you're doing. But at some point, you know, the novelty of it is, wait, what if it becomes boring? You're that musician and who's great, gets hired all the time, but you just aren't happy. Well, maybe the novelty is important too. So I don't like to pit those, to cap that off. I don't like to say pit those against each other. But I think those of us who would deny the novelty part are more culpable in this, perhaps, of it. But some people might be saying, I'm great at this, but I'm still not happy. Maybe it's because you just need to mix it up. Break a rule.
Yeah. Great nuanced answer. Anytime I ask or question, it's a trick. It's a trick. It's a trap. Because the answer is usually end.
It's a trap like that meme from Star Wars. It's a trap. The lobster guy. It's a trap.
It's a trap. Don't go into it. But I do want to go into the writing aspects and then tie that into decluttering. Because I think that's another very important ethos of your book. So Daniel Kahneman, Nobel Prize winning economic psychologist, said in an interview that he does not believe in sunk cost at all. So if he needs to delete an entire manuscript and restart from scratch, and he did this through a book, Thinking Fast and Slow, he will do it. No hesitation. Of course, that's a very extreme, bold move, right? Because that book is dense. And I think from what I read, one of the chapters he deleted had a lot of words and he spent months on it. And when he had that strike of inspirations, he decided to just completely restart. And we have this amazing book that we have today. Any thoughts on sunk cost when it comes to creativity based on what I just shared?
Nothing is wasted in the creative process. Let's put it that way. I have probably a couple books of writing. And as I just explained that process, it was like five drafts because it didn't fit the focus. It didn't, you know, it took it in a different direction for a chapter or so. And that's expected, I would say. And part of this is the process of that is important because in writing all of those chapters, I was able to write the good ones. And there's some research that shows the more ideas you have, it's exponential. It's not just that, you know, I have 10 ideas, now I have 100, and so the same percentage. It's like 10 ideas, I have one that's good, so I have 100, I have like 50 that are good. It grows in that way. So doing more of it, so more writing. So all the things that we do, the muscle, the creating itself, this again, back to this whole thing about process, it keeps me, keeps all those muscles working in my brain, or not literal muscles, but, you know, elasticity in the brain working, and gives me that edge to keep creating. If I just only look at it only when I'm inspired or feel like everything I write has to stay in there and I'm disappointed about that, that's bad. That's why in that creative process towards the end, you start editing it. When you get it out to the world, you figure out, okay, I have great material, but these three things aren't going to resonate with the average person. They're too academic. So my editor tell me these four things are just really academic that I would question. And I get to choose as the author what I listen to, right? So I'm still making this choice, but am I going to listen to all this input and put it out? But that's the beauty of collaboration too, is you're able then to see that, and you can listen or not to your collaborators or argue over this works or this doesn't. A book, really, the best books aren't done with just one person. They're done with editors and people who give you feedback. Even if you write it all, they're the ones telling you, this is just a question I have. A story this person could not relate to whatsoever. I said, oh, that's kind of a weird culture thing. I guess I'm old.
Mark Manson, someone I came to mind, author of The Subtle Art of Not Giving F. He was a blogger, prolific, and they became an author. And also Seth Godin, who we started this interview with. I think they both said that every published book they've published comes with 10 unpublished books that people never see. But because of that, what they do publish is a timeless classic. And that's what made them prolific, right? Same thing for Daniel Kahneman. I'm sure it's the same thing. But I do really believe that because, like, I studied international relations and economics many moons ago in college. So I learned about the concept of sunk cost or sunk cost quite early on. But I do feel like in life, because in business, of course, there is sunk cost. You do have to measure the pros and cons, cost-benefit analysis. These are the pragmatic things we talked about. These are the conditions we do need to adhere to.
Your P&L sheet has to be made.
Right. You definitely want to make sure your overhead, right? All that matters because we're humans. We live in this reality where you have to pay your bills. But I think in life, generally speaking, if you view a lot of things through sunk cost, if you determine the outcome of where you're going based on the path you followed and you're like, oh, it's too much. I've already done enough. I don't think I need to write 1,000 words for 3 more days. I could take a break. I think it inhibits us to the other side because you get caught up in the wrong goalpost that you alluded to earlier. But I see a lot of grace and forgiveness. The fact that he doesn't believe in sunk costs, and I do feel like we can be a little bit more gracious because fixating on sunk costs implies that we prioritize, you know, certain things over your intentions or where you want to go.
I think that one of the conversations I had back and forth things was between utility and beauty. So everything doesn't have to have utility. Mm-hmm. If it has beauty, it has some usefulness to us as well.
True.
So there is some utility to something just existing that is a good piece of work that no one's ever going to see. In other words, a lot of artists will say this to younger artists in their books, and they think they're right, but it's not easy to hear because I didn't like it. Mm-hmm. Create for yourself. But I don't want to just create for myself, right? I want lots of people to enjoy it, you know, because that's part of the thrill of it. But the truth is it something I love enough that I get good enough at doing that if it was just for me, that I'd still love doing it? And being able to do that is empowering. So now I understand, after I've lived a little bit longer, that that's really a very good thing to do, is to give yourself freedom in that. So if it doesn't have utility, if a song, I can write a song no one's ever going to hear. It's like journaling, why journaling is so powerful. Our creations can become our journaling. Cutting room floor becomes a place, you know, for film. Literally, they used to cut, by the way, kids used to cut film and they throw it on the floor. And in the old days in the music studios, we actually had tape, 2-inch tape, which sounded great, I thought. But, you know, and it ended up on the floor. But that stuff on the floor actually is, you know, part of the beauty of what you're doing. The iterations. We don't like to celebrate. You made an iteration. You made a habit happen. You got from this little point to this point and you did it. Well, but I want to be over here. I want to have, you know, 95,000 books sold now, whatever it is, you know, as opposed to, but you did this. That goes to this. One author says, time plus direction equals destination. And I love that because what you sow is what you reap. So if I keep, even if I'm sort of doing it sloppily, but I'm going in the right direction, in enough time, I'm going to reach that destination. And I got to trust that process. And creativity is that kind of one of those kind of processes. Am I willing to see it as investment, like sowing? I'm going to reap something from it. There is profit from that because it's taking me somewhere as well. So it's both being, I'm in this moment in the process, learning to live, be human, but it's also what's going to happen at the other side. That's exciting. And we don't know what that is. Picasso didn't know what the meaning was to his audience because he said, I don't know what meaning people are going to find in it. I didn't intend it. But he kept creating, I think, because he knew people loved it and he loved doing it. And I think if we find that in whatever we're doing as people, as opposed to thinking everything has to have a purpose or utility, or I have to unconditionally love, here's the rules for that, it suffocates us.
I love the beauty and utility. And I think the problem starts with how we define and approach utility. Utility has beauty in it, right? And even like businesses, creating a business. I know people would think I'm crazy for connecting business as an art. I do think business is an art.
Mm-hmm.
Preparations, creating, iterations, collaborations. You're internalizing an idea. You believe in it, you internalize it, and you're externalizing an idea into this product that has its demands. There's beauty in that too, right? So I do feel like just like Sinner and Saint and the false dichotomy, beauty and utility can be viewed through the same lens. But I think it depends on your definition and your context and your approach and your willingness, like the cognitive disinhibitions that you talked about earlier. Are you willing to leave enough openness the way you view things? That's like the addiction to certainty we talked about before recording. If you're so addicted and adhering to this certain form and versions of certainty, you're going to miss out on everything else. And because that's, life is not linear, it's exponential. That's why I loved your book. I love that creativity is a process, because being human is also a process. Otherwise, what's the point of this life?
I think that, yeah, that being existential is a good thing, because you know, you only have so many laps around the sun. And so for us to not be grounded in that. And one person asked me, what do you feel like when you're really creative? And I said, that was a tough question. Like, what do I feel like? Because again, back to what we were talking about, me being connected to the feelings. And I said, you know what? It's strange, because it feels like I'm in my skin, in my body, grounded, but yet I'm flying. But it's because it's this person, but doing something that I'm really good at that moment in time. It's a moment like I can think of speaking, you know, when you're really in a zone and you're kind of in two places, but you're really grounded somehow in yourself. People may not see that. They see your muscle memory of what you're producing or singing, whatever you're doing. That's important. So life is like that, where am I willing to be that? If I can do that, it's great, because I'm living life. I'm breathing in. Obviously, we breathe in and breathe out, and there's only so many of those we have. And so that's why creativity is very important, because we could continue to complain about ourselves or the culture or the world and fight everything that's there. We can discover what's happening, who we are, see ourselves, see other people, and actually create something and actually move forward in life. And I think that's where a lot of that certainty is an enemy in a way, because it lets us off the hook from really seeing the nuances of how beautiful human beings really are, how just amazing. So don't we want people to thrive then? You got to be, you know, devout Christian and a secular humanist. The one thing that could bind us perhaps is, don't we want people to thrive? And that's kind of why I wrote that book, is because, you know, I want to thrive, but me thriving means you thriving. And it's all connected. It's not just my life. It's life.
Yeah, the human ecosystem, right? And yeah, I do feel like we need to discover more, pun intended, the beauty within us. Because I do feel like when we change our internal landscape, the external landscape changes accordingly. So in your last sections of the book, you talked about to transcend rules, you must know the rules first. To break the norms, you must know the norms first. To redefine beauty, you have to know what beauty is, right? In similar ways, I think to deal with other humans who are infinitely complex. You talked about we're sometimes complex. I think we're always complex, okay. Right? And we must know ourselves first. Because how can we know other people if we don't know ourselves? So like you said in the last sections, the way you close out the book, we must defeat our internal enemy.
Defeat the internal enemy? I think, is that how I said that? We have that. That's the dark side, the shadow that we have. I don't know if you're familiar with the Enneagram. Have you heard of that?
Mm-hmm.
So that one thing, the thing that makes that really different than like a personality thing, is it really helps maybe define a dark side that you have. This is my shadow self that I need to be aware of. And this is, you know, which may direct me to cope with things a certain way, or direct me to not see another person in the same lens I should. And so in being able to see the lens I have, which I'm a number four for those who know that, that's the person who they call the performer or the artist, of course, right? Duh. I'm pegged with that one. So that person, envy is the driving dark side. So, and envy doesn't have to look like I'm envious of you, which maybe I am, I don't know. It could be I'm envious of my younger self, or of an imaginated constructed thing that I have in the future I think I should work towards. That's not real, because it doesn't keep me in the moment. But, you know, in that section of the book, I really felt it important to explain kind of what I was dealing with, you know, like the should-haves. You can never win a should-have. All right, you should have done this. Well, I can't go back in time, right? And then maybe that's, there's never a situation I could recreate that's going to be that anyway. So that's really, it's going to keep me in a cycle, keep me in this loop forever going. In order to thrive, I need to get that out. I need to understand what are those voices in my head that aren't necessarily me or whatever, they're coping things, whatever they are that are just looping. And, you know, that's one of them for me, perhaps, you know, you should have done that. Or shouldn't you be at this point in life, a success at this point in life? You know, shouldn't you have this much in your retirement account, Rich? You know, all those kind of things, and they could be paralyzing. And that's the enemy. But they're not necessarily me. It's not me saying that. And at first, I thought, okay, maybe that's me saying these things. But no, it's not. This is the shadow trying to protect the little person that he used to be. So I think it's very vital to be aware of those things and then find people to help us with them, but not think of ourselves as the enemy. You know, we need to be our friend. We need to be the person saying, you know, no, this is not you. Are not the person you want to be. This is not a voice you need to hear.
And my psychologist colleague at USC, where I worked a lot previously, I have a new placement now, he said that the word should is just a word to make you feel bad.
I like what he said. That's great.
That's it, right? So whoever's listening, if you start saying, I should create, just create. I want to discover more, just discover more. I should do this, just do it, right? It's a process. And remember, one of the big messaging board from today's conversation that I took away from, aside from many golden nuggets, is replace the desire of should and replace the perceived goalpost with whatever you perceive them as. Just do it. Because by doing that, the iterations and process will take care of its own. And who you are, once you start that process, you wouldn't recognize because you're a different version of yourself. That's why goals also shift. The goals you made in the beginning before embarking on that journey versus the goals that evolved through that journey is different goals because you have changed. In that sense, we don't have to seek originality. We are all original. Even you and I, we write the exact same book, same editor, same processes, same 1,000 words a day. Our sentences, the rhythms, the cadences, our writing styles will be different because you have your entire life of experiences in genetics. I have my entire life of experience with my own genetics and different interactions. So even if you don't want to be original, you can't, because I think originality is innate to us by default.
Mm.
And that's what I want to conclude today's conversation with. But I really love the gracious theme that your book had, but also the idea that it is a process and there's room to dance. But to dance, you need to step onto the floor to begin with. For anyone that's inspired, they want to discover more, create more, be more creative, where they can find you, connect with you, and anything in between.
I have a site called rkblog.com, and I write like 5 to 10 minute posts, and I also record them so people can listen to them on a podcast. Just simple scripted. There's no guests. I'm not as fancy as you are at all. And in that, I hope basically have more of this conversation in small enough bites to kind of just give a person, you know, a taste of what's going on.
Awesome. I appreciate your thoughtfulness. I appreciate the immense research that went behind a book. I know just enough to know how cumbersome and tedious and stressful the process can be. So I appreciate you for creating this book and sharing this with the world, but also for really showing up today on the podcast.
My pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
And with that, hope to see you again in the next week's Train Up, Discover More. Thank you for tuning in.